Welcome to The Study. I'm Craig Robertson, bringing you a program dedicated to the life of the mind. This time we visit Jeff Lacey. Jeff is a civil engineer by profession, who has also had a long career as an environmentalist. A naturalist since boyhood, he has been involved with local environmental groups for around 40 years, during which time he has also given many talks and lectures and written numerous articles and pamphlets on many diverse aspects of the environmental movement. Latterly, this has culminated in his 2004 publication of Still Glides the Stream, The Natural History of the Yarra from Heidelberg to Yarra Bend.
Well, I suppose my mother strongly encouraged learning. My father died when I was very young, so my mother was the main influence there. Primary school, well, you know, it was a Catholic primary school in a country town, very under-resourced, but I think the teachers were a bit of a mixed lot, but, you know, some were good.
What town was it?
Shepparton. There were no particular books while I was at school. A few teachers were thought quite good, but I wouldn't. They certainly helped me with skills like physics and chemistry, English, but I wouldn't think of any of them as having a particular influence on my thinking.
Did you have books in the house?
Only a few, but you know there was a library at school, and in Shepparton there was quite a good municipal library which I used very regularly. My mother had a strong fondness for nature, which obviously rubbed off on me, but my real interest in natural history dates from when I was 13. I began to do a little bit of gardening, and then it was as if I connected with the earth. You know, I became really conscious of the plants and the way they come out of the ground and grow and diversity. And then immediately after that, I decided I wanted to know about birds and got Cayley's book out of the library and did lots of little excursions on foot or on bike to the riparian red gum forest along the Goulburn River. And so I began to teach myself bird watching from that point on. I did, apart from Cayley's book, I started picking up books of some naturalists, especially Charles Barrett from the local library, and found all that quite fascinating. Yes, well, I think my strong points were, on the one hand, languages, and on the other hand, science and mathematics. Well, we didn't really get science till I was in the year 9, and yes, I really got into that. I mean, I thought this was really interesting, and I think it was fairly obvious to me that, you know, I would go into something in the scientific area. I did at one stage have a job in an electrical shop, but I decided I wasn't really interested in electrical things as such. But I liked the idea of, well, finding out how structures work, bridges and buildings, and the fact that there was a lot of mathematics associated with it appealed to me too. So I lived at Newman College while I was an undergraduate. Oh, that was great. You know, it was really good being, you know, part of the university, you know, nearly all of the time, and having a lot of friends around, and having some people, you know, that I could really share ideas with at a deeper level. Well, like Jim Bowler. I was involved in the Newman Society, which was, well, a Catholic intellectual movement, and we were quite deeply studying a whole lot of things and discussing issues of the world and getting involved in some practical projects.
What period are we talking here now?
We're talking about the period 1955 to 58, 4 years I was an undergraduate. And there were certainly a number of people involved in that who became big names. Many years later, I went to the US in 1968, stayed there somewhat over 2 years. That was because I decided, like I'd had several years of practical experience in engineering and decided I wanted to go in for academic work. And I wasn't able to get a grant in Australia, but was able to get one at the University of Texas to do a PhD in structures. Yes, that was hard work, a bit alienating in a way. I mean, it was a very troubled time in the US, you know, the early Nixon years, the height of the Vietnam War. And so I got caught up in all that tension and stress. But I also became aware of some major thinkers like Noam Chomsky, for example, and Ivan Illich. Thomas Merton, I suppose, would be ones who stood out. From 1963 to 1965, I was on the initial committee of Australian Volunteers Abroad, but I found this particular job for myself. It was really sponsored by the church in part of what's now Bangladesh, which was then East Pakistan. And I worked as a kind of assistant to a cooperative movement. The movement was building up credit unions and was introducing a lot of education and the way of health, simple agricultural ideas too. So I found myself a role of, well, writing reports for that group, doing some international liaison for them, and then after a while I became the representative in Pakistan for Community Aid Abroad and got visited by David Scott, who was the head of that organisation.
So how did you come to be on that committee?
Well, this came out of interaction among a number of organisations. Like, there was the pre-existing volunteer graduate scheme for Indonesia that had been going from the early 50s. Then there was the Students' Christian Movement, the Newman Society, and one or two others. And people from that got together and formed, they called it the Overseas Service Bureau, and it soon became Australian Volunteers Abroad.
I was interested in to what extent your profession drew you into environmentalism, or was it the other way around?
Yes, I didn't come into it through the profession, because there was very little environmental awareness among civil engineers, we'll say, in the 1960s. But really it just came from my early experiments in natural history. I had that interest in the environment, and I kept wanting to bring together, you know, my work in engineering and my interest in the environment. Paradoxically, while I was studying civil engineering very intensively and for the PhD in America, I suppose developed a determination to try and do this integration, you know, rather than to do research in just simply engineering, to find a way of doing research into the environment, but in a way that brought civil engineering and the environment together. The job I got from 1971, for 4 years at New South Wales Uni, I began to, you know, create opportunities to do this. I think it was an evolution. I suppose my undergraduate days would be the real starting point, now, perhaps especially my involvement in the Newman Society, and I realised that for the rest of my life I'd be wanting to look deeply into the meaning of the work I was doing and everything related to it. Then the 2 years or so in Bangladesh were quite crucial, because I became aware of the whole idea of, well, community self-reliance, doing things in a small way, the cooperative way of doing things. So that was another key turning point. But after that, things gradually evolved. Experience, becoming aware of new writers. The time I was in America, I started reading the works of Ivan Illich, and just shortly after that, the works of Lewis Mumford. All these set me well and truly on the path of exploring deeply the implications of technology, the interaction with the environment.
The other thing that strikes me is that you began a long career of engaging with the public in various parts of Australia regarding all these issues. You have been giving talks and lectures for well over 30 years, I guess, working with community groups, research projects.
Yes, well, I suppose this public role came mainly from when I came back from Bangladesh. I was asked to give lots and lots of talks about that and the issues, especially by community aid abroad groups who wanted to get a better understanding about what ways they could help. When I came back from America to Sydney in 1971, that year coincided with the Bangladesh War of Independence, and so I became involved in that issue, like with in an Australian support group who worked very closely with a group called the Bangladesh People's Association. I kind of felt that the things I'd learned when I lived back there, I was able to put to perhaps more practical use then, some years later. But also, you see, it seemed to me that around 1970-71 was the beginning of the modern phase of the environmental movement in Australia. And in Sydney, I decided I definitely wanted to get quite involved with that. And yes, I wouldn't say the Limits to Growth report had an impact on me as such, because I was already thinking in terms of limits, you know, from the work of people like Illich and some others. But the Club of Rome report, I saw it as a great educational tool that I could use in talks, you know, for quite a number of years, really. So, yes, so I engaged with it quite a bit. But 1971, you see, the environmental movement was really getting off the ground, and so I looked around for what group I could work with in Sydney. The one I engaged with was called the Total Environment Centre, which started that year. It was started up by a remarkable architect named Milo Dunphy, and they engaged with a whole lot of environmental issues. Milo had a real charism, and he, you know, welcomed people like me that wanted to help out on some of these projects, and I in turn would get him to give, you know, the occasional talk to my class. Like, I worked at New South Wales University for 4 years, and I started to do these other projects after that. I came back to live in Melbourne again in 1977, and shortly after that got involved with Terry White and other people in Maryborough on a number of appropriate technology projects. For most of the environmental consulting I did, I didn't get any money for. There was the occasional job, like the one in Adelaide you referred to. Yes, I did get a small amount from that. So I paid work.
A bit of hand-to-mouth living in that, I think.
Yes. Pax Christi is an international Christian peace movement. I joined that when I came back to Melbourne in the late 70s too. Previously, in the early 70s, I'd been very active in the movement against the Vietnam War, but then in the early 80s, the disarmament movement became very big, and I became very involved in that. And with other people in Pax Christi, we were instrumental with other groups in setting up the big movement, People for Nuclear Disarmament. And I gave a lot of talks on those themes in the early 80s. Thank you.
Ian Holtham playing Secrets of the Amphitheatre from Linda Kouvaris' Bundanon Suite. You're in the study, and we're talking to Jeff Lacey, environmentalist.
Well, to me, nature, I think of it in a very concrete way. It's what we experience, the natural world, the world of the diversity of rocks and water and plants and animals, with all its diversity, or biodiversity as we say now. It's this biodiversity, I think, that we're trying to protect, and the diversity of landscapes. I very rarely use the word wilderness because of the ambiguities. I mean, we recognise now that practically the whole of Australia bears some imprint of human beings for tens of thousands of years. I might occasionally use the term wilderness in a rather descriptive way, you know, for a wild place where one is conscious overwhelmingly of natural things with a very minimum of development.
I read something by an Aboriginal one time, I can't recall the exact reference, but basically what it was saying then for them was that what we call wilderness is what they call, that was their country there, and it was civilised. Wilderness for them is what we've created out of white agriculture and mining and so forth. That's the wilderness. It's sort of like a mirror image or direct opposite of what we think of.
Yes, well, that mistake, of course, goes back to the beginnings of white settlement. Reading like the works of European explorers like Mitchell and early European settlers in Victoria, you keep coming across phrases like, the landscape is as park-like, as if formed by human hand, and which shows their great ignorance, because in fact it was partly shaped by human hands. So fortunately, the environmental movement as a whole, I think, recognises all that now and doesn't imagine that we're dealing with some sort of untouched wildernesses.
I'm not sure if the spirit of place ideas come up. Do you sympathise with that sort of concept at all, or is it like, as a Christian, do you see it some other way?
Yes, I never think in terms of spirit of place myself, but I recognise that it is important in some cultures. Well, Aboriginal mythology, as I understand it, like associating actual spirits being in particular places, and ancient European cultures had that too. But to me, if I'm in a place, it's the place itself that has an impact on me. The landscape, the rocks, the plants and animals, the uniqueness of that. It's this actual natural setting that I'm aware of. I don't tend to think of any local spirits myself, but at the same time, I also have a sense of, well, as it says in the Book of Wisdom, the Spirit of the Lord fills the earth, and there's the kind of mystery here that this great diversity we experience is at the same time the experience of the one and undivided. And so there's a mystery at a whole lot of different levels there.
What do you think of the Gaia concept?
I don't accept it. The Gaia hypothesis, as I understand it, is that the whole world can be thought of as a single ecosystem or even a kind of single organism. This hasn't been proved. On a smaller scale, I think ecologists have tended to get away from any notions of super ecosystems, so it seems to me it's highly improbable that it applies to the world. Also, I think it tends to fit in too well with a managerial approach to nature, and perhaps it's no accident that Lovelock, who came up with this hypothesis, is so strongly in favour of nuclear power.
Do you think there's a danger of romanticising nature in some way, that, which includes, I guess, projecting certain moral attributes into nature?
Well, I think the word romantic there has two rather different meanings. Like, on the one hand, there's what you say, you know, it can involve projecting certain human attributes onto nature, which is fallacious, but I'm a little bit acquainted, like, with romantic poets like Wordsworth, and more acquainted with the romantic tradition in painting, which, in fact, my favourite painter in Australia is von Gerhard, who's very much in the European romantic tradition, and it seems this really conveys a sense of wonder in nature, like the uniqueness of each scene and the mystery of it. And I think romantic in this sense is something I see as being very positive.
Looking at the social side of it, you've written some interesting stuff about this. For example, looking at the complex of things around the notions of work and what is a job, and you've written about, in terms of the means of subsistence, and gardening gets a lot of mentions, as you say. You started with this at 13, and all that stuff about self-reliance and the nature of community and how communities form and so on. And, I mean, do you have any sort of broad sense of how we could devise a socio-economic system that is sustainable and puts into practice these sort of ideas that you've talked about, and how you would do that without it becoming a static sort of hierarchical society? It does bother me a bit, the idea that, you know, you would set up some sustainable society and it would just sort of ossify into some rigid social hierarchy where there was a concomitant loss of personal liberty and creativity and so forth. So
I don't think ecological sustainability need be associated with a kind of static culture at all. Lots of cultures that lasted a long time, like Chinese, Indian cultures, for example, like, they have evolved, different ideas took place, different inventions. Now, there were periods where they weren't sustainable, but like with a lot of clearing, for example, in China, but there are other periods where they do seem to have been reasonably ecologically sustainable for quite a long time. If you think of Europe, say, from perhaps, say, the 10th to the 16th or so centuries, there was a lot of cultural change going on, but without major ecological disruptions. So I don't think there's a real problem about ecological sustainability and cultural dynamism.
I don't think there's any guarantee that if you get the environmental and the ecological things right, that the social things will necessarily be right. There has to be a sort of added dimension to a movement that's going to create a just society.
Well, look, I think that's quite true. We need to very consciously combine ecological sustainability with an equitable participatory society. We simply can't take one thing for granted. One won't necessarily lead to the other. We have to build the two things simultaneously, and it'll be a difficult job. We do need to very carefully look at the systemic causes of things. I'd like to kind of re-emphasised the alternative that's been neglected. You know, the world is dominated by global capitalism today. State socialism has been tried and failed in a number of countries. But the possibility of moving towards a cooperative economy has been ignored, even though there have been some very good and successful examples of cooperative ventures around the world. Now, obviously, we couldn't switch from global capitalism to a cooperative economy overnight, but it seems to me it's it's a direction we've got to keep in sight and to encourage all opportunities to move in that direction.
Well, how would you do it? I mean, you do, you reading your stuff, you, I mean, you do, it's obvious you recognise that corporations, for example, are centres of political power. You don't use the phrase political economy, but that's the sort of thing I understand, is, you know, a corporation's not just a business unit, it's a political organisation as well.
Yes.
And, I mean, socialism as such doesn't get much mention in your writings, but it seems to me the sort of society that you're discussing and pointing towards is one that I would have thought as a type of social society. But that was much debated back in the 60s and 70s, and now it's all sort of gone away. Nobody seems to talk about it anymore.
I think the time has come to talk about it again. And given the realities of global warming, all the implications of that, this represents an enormous failure of global capitalism, among other, for one thing. So a lot is going to have to change economically. We can't go on with this expansion of consumption of resources, energy and so on. So this does open up the possibility of what kinds of new economic ventures do we want.
I mean, a key issue here would, I think, is decentralisation. But it's all to do with the dominance of markets or the way that markets are constructed. How would you regulate markets? Do you see any realistic political way? Like, you know, Kevin Rudd's in power now, Peter Gates, Minister for the Environment. Is it conceivable that they could enact any legislation that would, for example, revive the idea of decentralisation? Even in our time, Whitlam tried to do something about it.
It's possible. I don't quite know the answer to that. I've always found dealing with ministers and governments a very difficult business. It's hard to gain ground, but we have to keep on trying. I suppose I'm putting my effort at this stage more at the level of consciousness, like trying to convey people this sense of the local, to be aware of nature at the local level, the local landscape. And, I retain membership of a credit union. If any cooperative ventures came up, I would certainly support them and be in if I could.
You know, looking at the historical side of it, reading your material, it was interesting, you know, to read again about things like the Lucas Aerospace Workers Plan, and there was Davis, California. And in the 70s, what I think was... I was part of that, getting this discussion about Aboriginal land practices going. Again, I think a lot of that seems to have disappeared off the map, or maybe I'm wrong, but you don't sort of hear about those sort of things much now. Are there any other contemporary examples like that people are looking toward as experiments to open up different models of development?
Up until perhaps the mid-1980s, the idea of an appropriate technology had a certain amount of support, but the developments, you know, the enormous developments in, I suppose, what you could call high technology, somehow eclipsed all that. But some things have survived. Like, as far as I'm aware, the energy... saving approaches developed in Davis, California were successful, and as far as I'm aware, they're still going. But the development of wind power, I think, is encouraging. I'm sure it wasn't done by cooperatives. It's been quite remarkable, the quality of the work done and the way that it's making real headway now, you know, that you've got wind power quite self-sufficient economically. See, if we take these things like solar and wind power, we have to bear in mind that there's no way that these can replace level of energy that we've got at the moment. Like, they all have their place, but to cope with global warming, our use of energy will have to be a tiny fraction of what it is at present. This is perhaps a harder message to convey, but it's necessary.
Ian Holtham playing Giants in the Land, the title track from his album by Brenton Broadstock. You're in the study, and I'm Craig Robertson, and we're talking to Jeff Lacey, environmentalist and natural historian. One of these main headings, which is technology. What you've read, people like Jacques Salal and Ivan Illich, pretty thoroughly. What's your overall view then of the whole way technology works?
Yes, well, I read quite a lot of books on that question. The writers I found most helpful on it, the two I'd say would, like Lewis Mumford, like his detailed work on the history of technology from way back, I found tremendously helpful. And the work of Jacques Ellul on, well, his sociological analysis of technology today. And I think he hit the nail on the head where he points out that technology is a system. All the different components of it hang together. And strangely, people don't recognise this. You know, we talk about an economic system, but we ignore the fact that we have a technological system, that's growing in a certain way, has certain characteristics that tends to simplify, well, nature. Well, for example, you build a dam and, you know, you turn the wilderness into so many kilowatts of electricity, that kind of thing. And what's particularly important is that, you know, our society has kind of committed itself to that without quite realising it. You know, we're aware of the motives of, you know, the profit motive and corporations and that kind of thing. But few people seem to be aware of the way our whole society, more or less, has committed itself to technological growth, and how somehow technological projects get a kind of undue priority. A current topical example, of course, is the project to deepen Port Phillip Bay, to take bigger container ships or whatever, to increase our trade with China and the rest of the world. Well, of course, there are all sorts of ecological objections to this and tremendous dangers, and the null position tends to be excluded in all these inquiries. Like, if you want to say, look, don't go ahead for these reasons, that's seen as negative. And so there seems to be an enormous impetus for something to get the go-ahead sooner or later. If I discuss it with my professional colleagues who don't have any particular personal stake in it, you're always pushing uphill, you know, you're being negative. But I think this is a good example of the way, you know, so many sections of society who don't, including those that don't have a direct economic stake in it, give this kind of priority to technological progress.
Mm. Mobile phone's the latest bugbear with that one. It's almost ruined public libraries for me.
Yes. Well, to me, the mobile phone was quite an absurd invention. I mean, people use it because, well, they want to be connected with whoever wants to contact them at any time. Well, it seems to me that this is we have an ordinary phone that one can get away from, and that's an advantage in not being available.
Yeah. I'd like to raise this whole idea of needs, the needs problem. And it brings up this idea, when you've discussed appropriateness or conviviality as attributes of technology that might be developed as an alternative culture of technology, but this centres around this problem of needs. How do we know what our needs are? They're constantly being invented for us by somebody else. How do you view that needs issue?
Well, exactly. As one of our friends would say, needs are socially constructed, aren't they? One advantage of realising that is that one discovers one's got a lot less needs than...
But if society is not, in fact, going to become static, needs will change, won't they? So there should be some sort of conscious way of...
Yes, well, there used to be a saying, necessity is the mother of invention, but I think now it's reversed. Invention is the mother of necessity. Something is invented, and then we discover we need it.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. In one of your papers argued about against nuclear technology in terms of false gods. Can you comment on that?
Oh, that was in reference to nuclear weapons. That was at a conference on nuclear disarmament, really. It's, yes, I suppose an idol is something that we invest power over. We invest it with power over ourselves. And nuclear weapons are very much this thing. We invest our national security in nuclear weapons, or in the case of Australia, a nuclear alliance where we provide the bases. The implications of this for our integrity, our freedom, are really quite staggering, yet so many people just accept that.
Well, that's sort of pointing us towards final of these major headings I've got here, is the moral, ethical, value issues.
I'm not sure if values have changed all that much in that period, within an overall perspective. See, I think our current mainstream view of technology and nature goes back to the scientific revolution. At that time, Descartes articulated perhaps more clearly than anybody else, and he saw, given the mathematical character of nature, which Galileo had discovered, it opened up the possibility of us literally becoming lords and possessors of nature. And I think that has been a bit of a guiding goal. I mean, this is the current mainstream attitude. Nature is something for us to dominate, to control. And the way we do this is technology, and this is the central phenomenon of our age, the central venture, the pursuit of technology. The awareness of the environment has certainly developed a whole lot, since the 1960s, but how many of the environmental movements are looking at these fundamental questions? Well, again, our friend Frank Fisher has talked about his discussions with people in some of these movements who just don't want to look at these deeper structural questions. So on the one hand, people do want to, reverse global warming, to preserve biodiversity, but very few people in the environmental movement seem to be looking at the root causes of all that and what needs to change. But there's no reason why they can't.
I was just thinking how discussing technology, here we are with a highly sophisticated little microphone between us, recording something that's going to go on the internet with all that computer
stuff. So we have to work with it to some extent, don't we?
Yeah, to me, I attach a lot of importance to little symbolic things that in a way are a bit absurd. Like, I'm in two of these Friends of Parks groups, one being a local one, Greenlink Yarra Bend. We're with dwindling numbers, you know, on a working day we might have, say, three people, all distinctly ageing, going and weeding a little part of the Yarra trying to encourage certain indigenous plants that aren't doing too well in the drought and pull out these weeds that have got a lot of potential for doing damage to it. And there's a sort of absurdity about this, a few old people doing that kind of thing while the rest of the world is sort of rushing by. But I think it's important to do this.
Carbon emissions.
It's important to to say, well, by doing this, to say, well, look, this is where the truth lies. It's important to recover this sense of the local and perceive the beauty in it.
Do you see any risk of creating an anti-humanist environmental movement? And the reason I ask this is because I'm really not happy about some of the outcomes of animal liberation, which Peter Singer was sort of the founder of, with no doubt great intentions, but you now have these people that are prepared to bomb veterinary clinics and so forth. And I'm a bit concerned that Lovelock and Gaia and some of those people might start to take up some of these extreme actions.
Well, I think you're talking about a very real problem there that I haven't really done much reading on. Although
I haven't heard of any power stations being bombed yet, but it wouldn't surprise me at all.
I think the kind of danger you say is there. I don't know that it's a major danger in Australia at the moment, but it is something to be aware of, I think.
How do you see the population problem then? Or is it a problem?
Well, I think it is a problem, but I think it's been a bit overdone by quite a lot of environmentalists. I mean, it is true, you know, the world's population can't go on expanding, but some people even speak as if that's a major cause of global warming. Which, of course, it isn't. I mean, global warming is caused primarily by the burning of fossil fuels, which is done by the well-off section of the world. I understand that expert bodies seem to think that world population is going to stabilise by X decades from now, but key things in bringing the growth rate down appear to be such things as education of women, providing access to basic amenities in very poor countries, especially in Africa. So I'm very much in favour of doing all those sorts of things, but I'm not sure that we really need to panic about population. If you take, say, the Amazon forests, it's under threat really from the top levels. It's not so much like the indigenous people in the Amazon are pretty small in numbers. They've always lived there. They're not doing any harm, but we really need to just halt all clearing of it.
I was once at a barbecue and some couple of the people there said, you know, for them there's a sort of supposedly environmentalist type people are saying that, you know, the human race is like a blight on an apple. It's just spread over the earth like a blight on a rotten brown apple. One of them reckoned that the whole of South America ought to be, human population should be removed from it, just create one big wilderness.
Well, isn't this really just one more expression of imperialism, but in a sort of sophisticated way?
Yeah, it is. Well, Jeff, your later work is strongly oriented to research and activity regarding water, wetlands and streams. For example, you've worked on the Yarra Bend, French Island, Barma Millawa, and birds are a prominent interest in this work. You co-authored Birds of French Island Wetlands. Were there any particular reasons you went in this direction? with your work, or just, I mean, it's obviously pretty logical sort of thing for a guy like you to do.
yes, that's a good question. In fact, when at the launch of my book Still Glides the Stream, the author Ken Simpson made the remark that I seem to be quite a watery person. Also, in the mid-90s, like when I was working at Melbourne University, that was on a project to do with groundwater. Yeah. So maybe it goes back to growing up by the Goulburn River, that I sort of a particular affinity for watery ecosystems like river edges, swamps, bays.
This provides a natural progression to the publication of Still Glides the Stream, which I guess is your sort of great work in a sense. In the book you describe the process of, the historical process of exploration of the Yarra and all the way, and all the things that have happened subsequently down to the present day, where it's a more of a story of renewal via community action. I think you must have enjoyed writing this book quite a lot. Well, can you tell us a bit about the genesis of it?
It was a bit complex. I'd been wanting to put down on paper in a systematic way, you know, my thoughts about landscape. Then they became a bit more concrete. Like, I'd been working in this revegetation group at Yarra Bend. Also, for a long time, I'd done a lot of walks along the Yarra. And I thought, well, this is it. This is the first way I'll make it concrete. I'll talk about this landscape, you know, this particular stretch of the Yarra. And then the opportunity came up to get a grant to do this. I then, you know, went to find all the sources I can, look up all the old pictures I could, interview lots and lots of people, including elderly naturalists, local historians, and all that. And
can I just ask, people like Gilbert White and Thoreau, were they influential on you in your outlook?
Yes, I certainly, well, you know, read or reread their stuff. Yes, especially I found Thoreau, you know, particularly helpful, because he did a lot of study of, you know, ecological change and put it down on paper.
Well, one of the things that seems to emerge there is this thing that landscape, ecology, and natural and social history, they all sort of come together in a single field of interest.
Here. Yes, exactly.
I guess I see this as in large respect to an exercise in reading the land. How do you see that idea?
Well, as a matter of fact, I've got another book waiting publication pretty soon, I hope, on the title Reading the Land, where I set out the scientific interpretation of landscape and then look at other perceptions of it too, like Indigenous people, artists, natural history writers, poets, people living on the land. And I do two case studies. I look at the different land systems in central Victoria to illustrate the pattern, and then I do a detailed ecological history of French Island. French Island once again.
Is there any particular thing for yourself that gives you happiness?
Well, yes, I suppose being in the landscape, you're looking at everything, looking at plants, looking at birds, that certainly does, and then being among friends.
How do you feel about the future then?
I don't have any theories whatsoever about the future. To me, what's important is to state the way it is, the way I see it is now, and talk about what needs to be done urgently, put the effort into that. What's going to happen, I don't know.
In my study, on a corner of the desk, I have had for many years now an old biscuit tin. It's been there so long I no longer remember where or when I came by it. It was just a practical thing. I use it for spare pencils and various stationery bric-a-brac. But I have become rather fond of it nowadays because on the lid is a painting by some unknown artist. It shows an old man sitting in a room in a cottage, evidently by himself, playing a violin. From his clothes and the decor, we can see it is in the late 19th or early 20th century, the pre-electric age, perhaps anywhere in the Western world, including Australia. To his left is a big open fireplace with a stout wooden mantelpiece. A beautiful fire is crackling away, and over it hangs a big iron pot suspended on a heavy chain. Just behind him to his right is a window with small wood-framed panes. Outside we can see a hint of a country garden. On the windowsill there is a flower pot and a small pile of books. At his feet is a bundle of sheet music, underscoring his expression of rapt concentration. It is a charming scene in its kitschy way. There is a great sense of peace and well-being, of enlightenment, indeed of civilization in this little picture. In its way, it shows us a low-tech world of the small and local, of culture and contentment in a probably remote community. And yet, of course, when we think about it, the big iron pot and chain would have been made in a foundry in a town at least some distance away, the glass panes too. The books and sheet music would have come from a city even further away, and the violin probably from another country. It's a world, although simple compared to ours, that is nevertheless global. And of course, in those times, production of these items often involved large armies of workers in massive industrial complexes with many unpleasant features. I guess now they're mainly in China and all that gets little attention. Very few people really want to go back to the old days of any period, and with good reason. But it makes it a very difficult proposition to find a sustainable, perhaps more importantly, a desirable social structure that balances the local and the global. How can we find one that works but doesn't destroy? Development of a certain kind rules, and one consistent feature of development is centralisation. Decentralisation seems almost a lost cause. I think political centralisation has a place. Farmers clear scrub in Queensland and affect the water supply in Adelaide. Only national governance can deal with that. Korea fills in a major coastal wetland and destroys a significant portion of the world's migratory birds. Only international governance can do anything about it. I'm not sure why I'm generally so reluctant to go along with development, at least as we know it, even though I don't want to live in the past any more than anyone else. There is always, of course, concern about the landscapes, the birds and other animals and plants that live in them, the air and the water. Maybe it's just the noise, visual blight, the incessant busyness, putting pressure on everything and everybody, the obstinate refusal of its tunnelled vision instigators to acknowledge anything else as more important. Sometimes you just wish they'd stop, just leave things alone. I can't help thinking a strong sense of beauty is needed as a central cultural value to us all. It's the one thing that might restore an effective sense of the sacred, one that drew limits without having to accept a religion, but still giving us a belief in some value higher than a dollar. As I prepare this program in January 2008, there is a big, academically high-level, 4 or 5 day conference coming up in Melbourne on the history of art. Speakers are coming from all over the world to fulfil a 60-page program. I did a search on the program. The sacred does rate a session. The word is often in quotes. But I found just 2 occurrences of the word beauty in the titles of 2 half-hour papers. They were Beauty and Horror on Afghan Rugs and Beauty and Truth in Nature about Japanese art. The latter sounded like my kind of paper, but hardly enough to justify the conference fee. I'm hoping beauty will make a comeback, and without any quotes too. Music in this program included the following. Ian Hotham's album Giants in the Land, including Secrets of the Amphitheatre by Linda Kavouras from her Bundanon suite. It's music drawn from the Shoalhaven River area. and the title piece, Giants in the Land, by Brenton Broadstock. And our two regular themes, The Bach Prelude in C from Book 1, BWV 846, played by Ronald Farren Price on his album Reflections, and a movement from Handel's Suite No. 5 in E Major, played by Elizabeth Anderson on her album The Convict Harpsichordist. They're all on Move Records, and full details are on the Study website at www.thestudy.net.au. And so, until next time, it's shut the door and reading lamp only in the study.